The right of return, as enshrined in UN General Assembly Resolution 194 of the year 1948, forms the basis of a just peace. But will Israel ever grant the refugees this right? Some 700 to 900,000 Palestinians fled into what is now the West Bank and Gaza during the war of 1948, known to Palestinians as the Nakba, the Great Tragedy. Those who were internally displaced now represent a population of 1 million Palestinians inside Israel itself. These have Israeli passports, but very limited land and other rights. A further 750,000 were made refugees during the June 1967 war, sometimes known as the Six-Day War. Today, between 3.8 and 4 million refugees are registered with the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, otherwise known as UNRWA. Of these, 33% live inside UNRWA's 59 refugee camps in the West Bank and Gaza, in Jordan, in Syria, and above all, in Lebanon. Others to Iraq. Why have Palestinian refugees not returned to their homes? How do Palestinians envisage a solution to their 60-year-long plight? A rare holiday atmosphere has prevailed on the Egyptian side of Gaza's Rafah crossing after the steel barrier was demolished 2 days ago. Palestinians have poured into Egypt, buying up everything they could find. One man was even seen leading a big cow back into Gaza. Israel's deputy defense minister has warned that Israel may now abandon Gaza, withholding electricity and water if the breach continues. However, Egypt says that it will soon reclose the border crossing. President Bush's recent visit to Israel and the West Bank was clearly aimed at achieving what Clinton had failed to achieve at Camp David and then at Taba in 2000. But given his record in Iraq and his fulsome support for Israel, few in the region believe that he has a serious agenda.
Is it possible for the Israelis and the Palestinians to work out their differences on core issues so that a vision can emerge? And my answer is absolutely it's possible. Not only is it possible, it's necessary. And I believe it's possible. Not only possible, I believe it's going to happen, that there will be a signed peace treaty by the time I leave office, I believe.
Against the background of chaotic scenes in northern Gaza and an analysis of President Bush's recent peacemaking mission, violence continues, with Qassam rockets hitting the southern Israeli town of Sderot and powerful Israeli missiles landing on Gaza. The Hamas government in Gaza was unimpressed by Bush's call for an independent Palestinian state.
As the visits of Bush to occupy Palestine end, we, the Hamas movement, think that Bush did great political service in favor of the Israeli occupation concerning the Judaization of the state, the right to return, and Jerusalem. On the other hand, we as Palestinians didn't gain any political fruits.
Visitors to Gaza describe it as a prison sealed off from the outside world, despite Israeli claims withdrawn from this crowded Palestinian enclave. Queues for bread and vegetables, let alone meat, are a daily occurrence for Gazans, for whom poverty is a natural phenomenon. Yes. I'd just like to say before coming to you, Dawood, that we have a map being shown, which will illustrate to a certain extent, I hope, what we're discussing today. But I wonder whether you could, Dawood, as an academic on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, just give us in a few words the background. I mean, as far as I understand, in 1948, between 700,000 to 850,000 Palestinians fled. Were they forced to flee? Were they encouraged to flee by Palestinian radio vans, as was originally said, or did they flee in terror?
Well, the historical evidence suggests just the opposite. Mm-hmm. Several studies, most recently that of Ilan Pappi, concurs that this was the result of a concerted, well-organized, and orchestrated plan to depopulate Palestine. If we were to return to the archives in Jerusalem, as Nur Masala had done, we will see that there was a campaign very early in the occupation of Palestine to expel its people. So what happened in 1948 was not a collateral damage, as is known in political and military jargon, but it was the consequence of a premeditated plan to empty the land of its people.
And they couldn't return because the 500 villages that they lived in were destroyed, I believe.
531. Mm. And they were denied the right of return, even though Israel was admitted into membership of the United Nations. Mm. According to Resolution 273, it obliged itself, it acknowledged the obligation to implement Resolution 194 of 1948. As we know, when Israel first applied for membership in December 1948, its resolution, the application was turned down. It was not until the summer of 1949 that it was granted membership. But that was conditional. The condition was that it implemented Resolution 194. It has not done so until today. And that resolution has been reaffirmed annually by the General Assembly until today. Thereby, given the resolution a status of what we call international customary law, because of the consensus and the consistency upon which it has been affirmed. So here we are, you know, looking at people in Gaza today, 80% of whom are refugees, not from the West Bank, but from villages and townships inside of Israel. Many of them can see their homes if the barriers were removed. And, you know, it's one of the great injustices of our time.
Thank you. But, Hussam, we then had the first Intifada, then we had the Madrid talks, 1991, and then the great Oslo Accord, 1993, which was supposed to give Palestine a state within 5 years and solve the whole refugee problem, crisis. And it hasn't been solved remotely, has it?
No, it hasn't. It hasn't. Because most of the previous assumptions, when they came to the to implementing them, have proven to be wrong. We were wrong believing that Israel was willing to engage in a process that would lead to the resolution of the conflict in a just, fair manner. We were wrong to assume that it was in the strategic interest of Israel to actually resolve the conflict, allowing for the establishment of an independent sovereign Palestinian state and for the return of refugees. These were the assumptions of the previous few years. But let me pick from where Dawood has just been referring to the fact that Israel was created by UN resolution, and it was its creation was conditional to respecting the UN resolution itself, 194, and what follows. But I want to even go back to 1917, to the very infamous Balfour Declaration, which to us represents very negative intervention by a third party in terms of our destiny and future by Lord Balfour of the UK government at the time, promising Jews of Europe and elsewhere a country in Palestine. But even in that very bad declaration itself, even in that declaration, Lord Balfour said that the creation of such a state should not in any way or another come at the expense of the indigenous population and the population of Palestine. Their religion, their identity must be respected. So by all means, by all legal arguments, by all backgrounds, Israel is in breach of its own even founding resolutions. And I would like also to add about the issue of refugees. Many people tackle this very issue from a political perspective. Yes, it has political connotations into it. Many would look at it from a humanitarian perspective. Mm. Indeed, I am a refugee myself, and it has a humanitarian...
From where? Where are you from?
I was born in Rafah refugee camp, to the very south of Gaza Strip, where people...
The heart of the crisis today.
The heart of the crisis today. Mm. And I was fed and educated by UNRWA as a refugee myself, one of the 3.5 million that you've just... a statistic myself. But I also would like to stress, emphasize, that this isn't only about politics and humanitarian
Let's just move on.
This is about the legal argument that people have the right to reclaim their private property.
Yes. We'll come back to the legal argument. It'll be very interesting. But, David, you've written quite a lot, both about the resettlement of Palestinians in what you foresaw in an article I read after the Oslo period. You foresaw a real Palestinian state emerging, and you foresaw a fantastic amount of resettlement going on in the West Bank. And you compared this with the resettlement of the immigration of Russians into Israel. But what is your view, just to go back before we discuss that, what is your view on the responsibility of Arab nations to, and Israel has often claimed that the Arab nations had the responsibility of absorbing the refugees. Do you think that's right?
I think you have to make a distinction here between two very different spheres of discourse. One is, of course, the political and the moral responsibility of the sides involved in the conflict to reach conflict resolution. And there are assumptions on both sides. And just as my colleague here argued that maybe they were wrong in relating to certain Israeli assumptions about wanting to make peace, I would dispute with him. I think the Israeli on the street very much wants to reach peaceful resolution of the conflict. I think many Israelis on the street today would say, you know, we were wrong assuming that the move towards conflict resolution would bring an end to violence, and what it brought to us on the street was suicide bombers and Katyusha rockets coming in from somewhere else. And that's obviously the whole political discussion which has to be resolved. Referring back to the article that you talk about, that in a sense is the next stage on. You know, what do we do? How do we go around resolving many of the very significant employment, housing, technical issues if and when the two sides are really around that table, bashing out a bilateral agreement with each other? How do you resolve the issue of refugees and resettlement? And I think Israel has shown that you can, under situations of crisis and emergency, take in tens and hundreds of thousands of refugees, and you can provide those technical solutions. You can create housing, you can create infrastructure, although it's much more difficult, of course, to create employment. But having said that, you have to first of all resolve the political and the moral issues. Do you want to reach conflict resolution? Do you have leaders on both sides who are prepared to move that extra step forward and get there?
Thanks very much. I want to bring Astrid in now, because I think these are the points we'll come back to in the second half of our program, because they're quite... You need a lot of analysis. But Astrid, could you say something about the very present-day situation of Palestinian refugees who are stuck, I think you said 15,000 in Baghdad, and several, 2,500, I believe, on the Iraq-Syrian border. What is their plight, and what is their future?
Well, they are living in a very, very difficult situation. They have been there for many years. Some have come in the 50s, some have come in the 60s, 70s. They've been living there for a long time, but their situation got more and more difficult after 2003. Some of them had been living in houses where other Iraqis had been expelled from, basically. So when these people came back, they expelled the Palestinians again. And like many other Iraqis, under the circumstances, they became subject to kidnappings, killings, threats, very, very difficult situation. A lot of them in basically 2005, well, already in 2003, but even more in 2005, started fleeing towards the Syrian and the Jordanian borders. In 2003, we had people at no man's land in Iraq, at the Iraq-Jordanian border, and in a camp in Jordan. And these people were basically stuck there for the past 4 years. In 2005, we got people arriving at the Iraq-Syria border, and they are still stuck here, some 2,500. We've been trying to find solutions for these people, because of course they're living in an extremely difficult situation.
Are UNHCR is entirely responsible for feeding them and housing them at the moment in tents, is that right?
Yeah. UNHCR is responsible for Palestinians outside the UNRWA area, and that is Iraq. As one example, there are other areas, but that is the main one. We're taking care of them. We are working together also with the Syrian Red Crescent Society in the no man's land, with other Iraqi Red Crescent Society. But we're working together trying to help them. But they're living under terrible circumstances in a camp, in a desert situation, cold winters, extremely hot summers. They're prone to fires. Their tents have gone up in flames. We have seen a lot of sick people, a lot of sick children. So it's a totally inhumane situation. Mm. And their problem is they have no access into Syria, no access into Jordan, who already have a large number of Palestinians, and no access into the other countries. So for us, it's been extremely difficult finding solutions for them and giving them a humane solution, basically.
Yes. Hossam, does this sound like the worst situation? I beg your pardon, Hossam. Dawood, does this sound like the worst situation you can think of in terms of refugee, Palestinian refugees?
Well, they are an exception in the sense that their problem is the longest known situation in the world today. It's ongoing since 1948. The people we are speaking about in Iraq, many of them, when they are descendants of first-generation refugees. But beyond that, if we look at the performance of the United Nations in the last decade and a half, we see that all the refugee problems that were resolved by the UN were resolved on the basis of repatriation.
Yes.
Whether we speak of the Dayton Accords as pertaining to the Balkans or Cambodia or Rwanda, it's all always on the basis. This is the preferred option. Repatriation is the preferred option. Palestine is the exception. And we have to, you know.
Well, because is it the exception because repatriation is not going to happen?
Well, because of the obstacles and the intransigence of Israel to engage on the basis of 194.
Yes.
You see, and its non-recognition of its responsibility, its moral and legal responsibility. Now, if we want to speak about conflict resolution, the first thing we have to do is to address the fundamental grievance.
Yes.
And the fundamental grievance of the Palestinian people is that they were pushed into exile.
Hossam, Lebanon is probably the biggest problem. I mean, this week, obviously, Gaza looks like the biggest problem in the region. But the, I mean, I was there a few years ago in Sabra and Shatila, and the situation seemed, I was there two years ago, situation seemed absolutely hopeless for the Palestinian refugees in Beirut.
Lebanon is a problem, but so are refugees in Gaza itself, or refugees in the West Bank, so is refugees in Syria. Yes, Lebanon is one of the harshest situations for several considerations and reasons, but the issue in its entirety as a whole remains to be very problematic. These are pressure points, and they might not erupt today, but they will erupt certainly tomorrow. Yesterday we saw Gaza and what happened, and then perhaps something might happen somewhere else. What we need to do is to look at this case from several angles and lenses, and really not to be stuck with some previous convictions about the situation. This isn't about political considerations any longer. This is about the stability of the entire region. I think many countries, the well-being of people are at stake as we speak. The argument itself that these people cannot go back to Israel simply because Israel defines itself as a Jewish state is a very racist argument. I think this very exclusive way of looking at things should be redefined. According to many studies, and I'm sure my colleagues here have seen some of them, in fact, repatriation and the return of refugees is not a technical issue. It is implementable, it is doable. In fact, one of these studies, which to my opinion very very serious, have found that actually most of the original villages of Palestine are still at large, are not populated, and therefore people could go back.
Why can't they, David? Why can't they return to Israel?
I think when you talk about fundamental grievances, I think one of the common elements of this terrible conflict is that people on both sides don't really look into what the psyche of the other side is saying. Well, I agree to a certain extent about the fundamental grievance on the Palestinian side of the need to resolve in one way or another the refugee situation. The other side doesn't understand the psyche of Israel, which is the fundamental grievance is that the Jewish people need their one single state in which they constitute some form of majority, and to a great extent they see the issue of repatriation very much as as big a security threat to their own existence as they do, say, the armies or the rockets.
But why couldn't they return to the West Bank and Gaza?
Why couldn't who return to the West Bank?
Why could the refugees not be allowed to return into the Palestinian?
Under a situation of a two-state resolution, where both states are totally sovereign, each state has the total right to determine who will or who will not return to their own territory. Under the present situation where occupation continues, this is obviously an asymmetrical situation in terms of the power relations. But as far as Israel is concerned, in terms of its 1949 borders, after its own war of independence, or as the Palestinians know it, as the Nakba, as the disaster, then obviously Israel sees it as very critical to ensure its own Jewish majority. And if I could, just one more sentence, say that I think, you know, if you were to poll or survey the Israeli public from right to left, you would find that, say, 90% of the Jewish citizen population of Israel would buy into that argument, including many people on the left who have been very active in the peace movement, who have been very sort of forthright about the needs for a Palestinian state and Palestinian rights.
Well, I'd like to come back to an open question. I might start with Hussam, and after the break, come back. Dawood. Basically, if this is the case, why has Israel built these vast settlements all over the West Bank? Because it looks as if they're there to stay.
I want to address something here. David just mentioned about, you know, the majority, the fact that Israelis want to be a majority in the state. They are a majority in their state right now. And the one-fifth of the Palestinian, many of them are refugees inside Israel. And they are not given their basic rights, which their villages are regarded as unrecognized villages. They denied health, education, electricity, the basic amenities of life. And the whole notion of becoming a majority state is a very elusive sort of dream. It will never happen. All the studies by Israeli research institutes concur.
I understand. I'll cut you short now, but we'll carry on after the break.
They concur that by 2050...
Thanks very much.
By 2050...
Cut you short now, Dawood.
The Jews would be a minority.
We're heading for a short break. Please stay with us.
Palestinians are once again crossing into Egypt from Gaza. This comes after Egyptian security forces failed to close the border. Meanwhile, Hamas has accepted an invitation by Egypt's president to hold talks in Cairo with Fatah leaders. Fatah has not confirmed its participation yet. Iran has called on the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization to act against Israel's blockade of Gaza. Iran's envoy to UNESCO says the international organization needs to fulfill its responsibility in defending the rights of Palestinian women and children. Former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi wants immediate elections after Romano Prodi was forced to resign. Berlusconi, who is a billionaire businessman, is ahead in opinion polls and would almost certainly win if his snap vote is held. He resigned after losing a confidence vote in the Senate. Young people in Kenya affected by the violence have gathered for a late-night vigil organized by Concerned Youth for Peace Center. Youth from shanty towns across Nairobi came together to talk about how they have been affected by events following the disputed presidential elections. Euros, dollars, and Bolivian pesos are piling up in the markets of South America's poorest nation. Bolivia is holding the festival of Alacita, in which thousands of people gather to pay homage to Ecuco, the Andean god of wealth and abundance. A fire on the roof of the Monte Carlo Hotel in Las Vegas has forced guests to flee. The fire spread from the center section of the hotel up to the roof. No major injuries have been reported. And finally, a baby polar bear in the Nuremberg Zoo has learned to crawl. The five-week-old bear, named Flock, is already half a meter tall. The baby bear was separated from her mother after officials became concerned the mother might harm her cub.
Hello and welcome back to Middle East Today from London. We are discussing the issues of the Palestinian refugees. What is their future? To discuss this question, we have today here Dr. Dawood Abdallah, a researcher at the Palestinian Return Centre in London, Hussein Zomblot, the spokesperson for the PLO in London, and Professor David Newman, editor of the International Journal of Geopolitics and professor of politics the department at Ben-Gurion University. And connected by satellite from Geneva, we have Astrid van Genderen Stort, who is the Senior Public Information Officer at the UNHCR in Geneva. Astrid, I wanted to come back to you because it's a very interesting story. The Palestinian refugees, both in Baghdad and suffering terribly, apparently, as you say, on the Iraq-Syrian border. Apparently, you're resettling them, UNHCR is resettling them in various countries, including Canada and Brazil. Could you say a bit more about this, please?
Well, obviously, I mean, this is a solution that we've been driven to by the circumstances. I mean, first and foremost, what you want is people to stay, I mean, either, as was discussed before, to return home if they can, or to stay in the country where they have already fled to. Now, the problem with Iraq is that at the moment, I mean, for a lot of them, it's not possible. We've tried to find access for them into Jordan and Syria, who have both said that they have too many already. I mean, they've received a lot of Palestinians and cannot host more. So we had to look further. We looked in the Arab region. Mm. We've appealed to various
governments
in the region.
What about Sudan? Wasn't Sudan one of the countries that was discussed?
This has been, it's been a long, long process, and Sudan has been one of the many, many countries that we've approached, and they've finally come forward last year with a willingness to possibly take up a group of the refugees that have been in a terrible conditions. And it's mainly because they're in such inhumane conditions that they've agreed to do that and provide them with a better life. And because the people themselves are so desperate, they have to get out of there to be able to pick up life again. I mean, that's basically the main solution for, I mean, the main purpose for us is to give them an life again.
Yes.
So before we managed to resettle some people to Brazil. People might say it's very far. It is far. There has been there is an Arab community there, but the people, of course, have gone there only because they wanted themselves a better life, and there was no other solution. They have left. We are in contact with them, and they're having a good life. And of course, if ever the solution, the possibility for them will come up to return home, which we're discussing tonight, they would have that right. Yeah. But in the meantime, to give them the solution, a more humane life, we're trying these different options. Sudan is one. Chile has offered some places for people at the border, but not enough for all the 2,500 who are there stuck now for several years.
Let's just carry on this issue, actually, David. I mean, before we return to the previous topic, what about resettling? I mean, is this an option, resettling Palestinian refugees in faraway countries?
I don't think that's really an option that Israel